Last week, I went through what I called a summary about the fate or the end of the wicked, what the Bible says, and we looked at several passages of Scripture. There's, on your handout, there was a whole bunch of Scriptures from the Old Testament that talk about the end of the wicked. And then we looked at the New Testament as well, and we looked at the terminology that was used in both of those, in the Old and the New Testaments. Terms like die, death, consume, perish, destroyed, be silent in darkness, burn up, consumed like chaff, cut off, are no more, melt away, be ashes, permanent contempt, burn with unquenchable fire, be stubble, be no more, be as though they had never been, vanish, vanish away like smoke, cut down like the grass, no more, and could not be found. And those were the terms that we found in the Old Testament about the end of the wicked. Then the New Testament, the terminology that we found in the passages that are listed there are very, very much the same. In danger of Gehenna fire, cast into Gehenna fire, destroy both body and soul, condemnation of Gehenna, perish, permanent punishment, destruction, swift destruction, permanent annihilation, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish, outer darkness, die, death, burn up, burn with unquenchable fire, outer darkness, weeping and gnashing of teeth, perdition, permanent blackness of darkness, passing away, second death, cast in the lake of fire. Those are the terms that we found for in the New Testament as well. And what we noticed was that in several of these cases, the New Testament is borrowing language directly out of the Old Testament. That is, it's referencing specific passages from the Old Testament. That's sort of a snapshot of just the terminology that's used for the fate of the wicked. Now, the thing that's really mind-boggling to me is that nowhere in the Bible, with the possible exception of one passage, which we're going to talk about, does the Bible ever talk about torment as punishment for an extended period of time for the wicked. All right? Nowhere. Now, if you take the book of Revelation out of the equation, and we're going to talk about this one passage in Revelation in a minute. If you take that out of the question, and the book of Revelation was not even given until several decades after all the other apostles were gone, where they were dead or had been martyred and so forth. It was roughly about three decades after the destruction of Jerusalem, which was almost, 50 years after, or 40 years after Jesus was crucified and sent the apostles out. The church for the first several decades did not have access to the book of Revelation, hadn't been given yet, and so all they had was the rest of the New Testament and the Old Testament to go by. When the book of Revelation was given, as we look at Revelation, we probably shouldn't assume that Revelation is telling us something that is nowhere else talked about in the entire Bible. I mean, I'm not saying it couldn't do that, but what I'm saying is the assumption should be that Revelation is probably going to be consistent with what has been talked about in the rest of the Bible. Would you agree with that as a reasonable assumption? And adding to that is the fact that the book of Revelation is constantly on every page referencing the Old Testament, quoting from the Old Testament, drawing metaphorical language out of the Old Testament. Therefore, the idea that Revelation is going to insert something that's completely opposite of what the rest of the Bible has taught up to that point is really an unreasonable assumption to make. Now, I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm simply saying we ought to try to make Revelation, look at Revelation in a way that it would be consistent with what came before it, not in a way that is going to completely overturn what came before it and say something entirely different. All right? Now, what I want to do is I want to look at that one passage in Revelation that people believe teaches that the wicked are punished eternally. They're tormented forever and forever. So let's take our Bibles and let's go to Revelation chapter 14. I'm going to read the passage and then I want to get your first impressions from this, okay? Having gone through all that we have so far, let's begin in verse 9. I'm going to read to you verse 9 through 12. Then the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark in his forehead or in his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Now, does that passage sound to you like the wicked are going to be tormented forever? What's that? It does, doesn't it? What is it? Okay, what is it about the passage that gives you that impression? Go ahead, Jordan.
Mm-hmm. The ones worse than the beast. It sounds like it's not that they're dead, but they're suffering through pain day and night for extended period of time. Mm-hmm. At least that it sounds like on the surface.
Okay, it does. And we'll have to acknowledge that it does sound that way. It sounds that way if you read it in the English translation. Now I'm going to show you what the grammar implies that is not evident in English. See, you know, I know this is one of those things. It's okay, here he goes again. You know, he's telling us that our English Bible can't be trusted and that you can't know what you're talking about unless you can read Greek. Right? Well, I'm not trying to give that impression, but facts are facts. Okay? And I know Jordan is studying Greek and he can correct me if I make a mistake. All right, Jordan? All right, here's some of the things we want to point out. We want to observe certain things first, okay? The first thing I want to observe is notice it says that whoever takes the mark of the beast or worships him, in verse 10, he himself also shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength. Notice that, full strength wrath. Therefore, whatever is being described here is the wrath of God in its extreme, right? In its extreme. Now, one thing you need to know about Revelation is the book does not give us a continuous chronology from beginning to end of the end times. The book of Revelation is written just like the book of Daniel, exactly like it, same format. The format is it gives you a big picture first, and then it comes back and it fills in sections with more information about certain aspects that were already described. So it's not sequential. It's sort of like a book that has a lot of appendixes at the end. All right, that's how Revelation is written. Now, what you find is that certain statements that are made early on, just sort of in passing, later on, there'll be a large section devoted to that particular topic. For example, the destruction of Mystery Babylon is mentioned in this chapter. All right, it's in verse 8. Babylon has fallen, the great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And that's all it says about Babylon. And you don't hear any more until we get all the way back to chapter 17 and 18, and you have two whole chapters devoted to the destruction of Babylon. All right, two whole chapters. It's sort of like an in-depth description of what Mystery Babylon being destroyed that was mentioned much earlier in the book was about. And we have the same things going on throughout the book. That's how the format of the book. So when it talks about the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength, you would expect that theme, or you could expect that theme, to be developed later in the book, and it indeed is. In fact, it's developed in the very next chapter. Chapter 15 starts out by saying, "Then I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, for in them the wrath of God is completed." Now, what is he saying? That God is going to sum up and fulfill his wrath with these last plagues. Okay? That's the point. And then he goes on. All right, let's go back to chapter 14, verse 10. What I'm going to propose to you is that the torment that is being talked about in this section is the torment of living people by the plagues that God is pouring out upon them, and it is during the last half of the tribulation that they are being tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of Christ and the presence of the angels. All right, now I'm going to prove that to you by the grammar. All right. Okay, the first point was that he says he's talking about the wrath of God being poured out full strength, and the vials or bowls of judgment are the wrath of God completed. Also, you wouldn't expect the wrath of God to continue on and on and on if it's being completed there. Also, I want you to notice the fire and the brimstone. It says they're tormented with fire and brimstone. Has that been mentioned earlier in the book of Revelation? Does anybody know? It has. In the trumpet judgments, it was mentioned. And the latter three trumpet judgments all occur in the last half of that time of tribulation. Let's flip back to Revelation chapter 9. All right. All right, we have the fifth angel sounding at the beginning of chapter 9. And it says in verse 3, then out of the smoke locusts came on the earth. To them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power, and they were commanded not to harm the grass or the earth or any green thing or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God in their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. Their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. Now, that's pretty severe torment, isn't it? Right? In those days, men will seek death, but will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. Wow. Suicide won't even work for these people. That's a pretty staggering thought, isn't it? The shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle, and so forth. It goes on. Then let's go to the next plague, down in verse did somebody say something? Actually, it's farther than that. It talks about the another army that was similar to the previous one. Verse 17, and thus I saw the horses in the vision. Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulfur yellow, and the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. By these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone, which came out of their mouth. So we have the fire and brimstone here as a plague earlier on in the tribulation. Their powers in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails are like serpents having heads, and with them they do harm. And the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. Now, what's interesting is if they are being tormented with fire and brimstone, now it says a third of them died, but the rest of them, it says they refused to repent, which doesn't mean that they died. It means that they were tormented by the fire and the brimstone and so forth. That was part of that plague as well. All right, so go back to chapter 14. Verse 10, he himself, that's those who take the mark, will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Notice it's in the presence of the Lamb. Now, question, is Jesus, he's the Lamb, right? Is Jesus going to go and sit down at Gehenna and watch people burn forever and forever? Is he? Yes.
Isn't Gehenna's location not far from the holy city?
It's not far.
He could watch it.
But in the presence of is a phrase that is pretty much everywhere else means in the immediate presence. That is, someone is intentionally standing and observing something going on. All right, so I want you to notice that it's in the presence of the Lamb. Also, where do we first learn about the Lamb in Revelation? Does anybody know? It's in chapter 5 and 6. When the seals are about to be opened, and John was being shown what was going on, and no one was able to open the seals on the seven seal book, right? And so one of the elders comes to him and says, look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah is going to open the seals. And then he says, I looked and behold a lamb as though it had been slain. And he, that is the Lamb, went and took the scroll. And he is the one who opens the seals. The Lamb is the one who opens the seals of judgment during the time of the seals that have been described all throughout chapter 6. All right? So we have the Lamb is the one who is sort of instigating these judgments and observing them as they are being played out. All right? That's just something to observe. All right? Now look again at verse 11. It says, the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. Now, what's critical, if you take that phrase forever and ever out of this passage, then there's nothing here that implies that this is something that goes on for a long time. It says day and night, but day and night could be, you know, 2 or 3 days, right? If you take that phrase out, okay, so just keep that in mind because that phrase is not translated correctly. Actually, it's, well, we're going to get into that. In fact, all of next week we're going to talk about the terminology of forever and ever in the Bible and eternal and everlasting, where those words come from, where those concepts come from, how they were translated, why they were translated the way they were translated, and all that. All right, so that's next week's sermon or lesson. All right, it says, now here's what I want you to see. It says, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast. And worship is in the present tense. And his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Now, literally, do you have your Greek text there, Jordan? Mm-hmm. All right. Literally, what it says is, they have no rest day or night, those worshiping the beast. Worshiping is a present participle. All right. Now, they have, where it says they have no rest, have is a present indicative verb. That means it's talking about the present, that is in this context, okay? The present. A present participle that's attached to it is telling us that this is, time is relative to the main verb, which means, I know that's all Greek to you guys, what that means is the ones worshiping the beast are the ones who are having no torment, that are being tormented day and night. Okay? They have no rest, comma, the ones who are worshiping the beast. You see what I'm saying? You hear what I'm saying? What it's doing, the construction in Greek, what it's doing is it's putting the time element together with the worshiping and being tormented. They are being tormented while they are worshiping the beast. In other words, that language requires that this time of torment is during that last 3.5 years of tribulation while they're worshiping the beast. We know that they worship the beast only during that last 3.5 years. That's actually talked about in chapter 13, the beast and his mark and his image and all that. All right, now, let me show you the next clue. Verse 12 says this, here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. Now that verse seems kind of out of place until you understand what the word here means. The word here in this verse is a Greek word that means at that location. Okay? At that location. That's what it means. You could literally translate it at that place, at that location. So what it's saying is there are people who are being tormented who are worshiping the beast. And then the next verse says, at that location is the patience or endurance of the saints. And then it uses the word again here. At that location are those who keep the commandments of God in the faith of Jesus. That's literally what it says. Now, so wait a minute. If these people are in hell someplace being tormented, why are the saints there? That's the problem. Why are the righteous there? Why are the saints who are persevering in trial and tribulation there? That verse literally says that they are at the same location. All right? So, How can that then refer to something that occurs while the saints are in the kingdom and these people are now so supposedly burning, in hell or whatever? The point is, what it's telling us is that while the beast is being worshipped, those who have chosen his mark and who are worshiping him, God is going to be tormenting them during that same period of time. But not only that, there are going to be some righteous people there as well who are keeping the commandments of God and have the faith of Christ. They're not going to be punished. He distinguishes the punishment that only those who take the mark of the beast are the ones being tormented, while the righteous are not being tormented by God at all. But yet they're there and they're enduring as well. And we actually go over to chapter, where was it? I think it's chapter 16. No, I know what I'm sorry, what?
Reminiscent of the plagues of Egypt a lot, how they're
yes. Yes. Now, here's something else. Notice verse 12. And I want you to notice the description of the righteous. What is the description of the righteous that are there? It is they, those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. You see that? Those who keep the commandments of God. Where have we seen that before? Well, you don't remember, but when we went through Revelation, go back to chapter 12. You remember when we talked about the woman who was preserved in the wilderness by God? She was given two wings like a great eagle, and she was she fled into the wilderness where she has a place to be preserved by God. You remember all that? Well, look at the last verse in that chapter. It says, "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring." Now, the rest means the remnant. It literally says the remnants, plural, of her offspring. And notice, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The exact same language that we see in chapter 14. Now, he's already described this group by that language. And it's the remnants who have not fled into the place of safety, but they're still faithful believers. All right? It's those remnants that he uses there. And so when we get to chapter 14, and he says, here or in this place, or in that place, is the patience or endurance of the saints. Here or in that place are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. When he says those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus, he's referring us back to when he first mentioned those only two chapters back he mentioned them. So he's telling us where they are. That's what he's doing. Where are they? They're in the midst of all this plagues and torment that God is pouring out upon those who worship the mark of the beast, yet they are enduring patiently in that. And they're not being tormented by it. Now, something else about the bowls of wrath that follow this immediately, which are the full measure of the wrath of God, and that is that the bowls of wrath are poured out specifically only on those who have the mark of the beast. You see that in, look at verse 1 and 2, chapter 16. "Then I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, 'Go and pour out the bowls of the wrath of God on the earth.' So the first went out and poured out his bowl upon the earth, and a foul and loathsome sore came upon the men who had the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image." You can see very clearly that the bowls of wrath, that is the undiluted wrath of God, is poured out, but it is said to be poured out selectively only on those who have the mark of the beast and on those who worship his image, which means all those who belong to God are immune from these things. That's what it means. Right? Does that make sense? You guys get that? God can target his plagues. He can target them to individual people. Not only that, you can be one righteous person in a crowd of 10,000 wicked people during this time, and God can smite the entire crowd and spare you. How do I know that? Because Psalm 91 says that. Did you know that? Look, keep your finger here. Go to Psalm 91. It says that exactly. Verse 1, he who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, he is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in him I will trust. Surely he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor the arrow that flies by day, nor the pestilence that walks in darkness. And if you look at Revelation 16:1, that's a pestilence right there. That's only coming on those who have the mark of the beast. He says, nor the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor the destruction that lays waste at noonday. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not come near you. Only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, who is my refuge, even the Most High, your dwelling place. No evil shall befall you, nor shall any plague come near your dwelling. For he will give his angels charge over you, to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they will bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Now, what is this chapter talking about? It's talking about God preserving the righteous during his plagues of judgment. There are many similarities in Psalm 91 to the plagues of Egypt. And what God did back then, what did he do? He spared his people, the whole Passover thing that we celebrated not long ago, right? His people went, as long as they were in that house and they had the blood on the door, he spared them when the death angel came through. The next door neighbor might die, but their house was spared. Isn't that right? Well, it's the same concept. But David's not talking about what happened in the Exodus. Why? Because he uses all future tense. Future tense, future tense, future tense. What happened in the Exodus was all long, long past. He's saying this is going to happen to us. That's what he's saying. It's protection. It's talking about the last days when the plagues, many of the same plagues are going to be repeated. Now, all right, after saying all that, the only problem here with my interpretation I've given you, which is consistent with the Greek grammar and is consistent with the way Revelation works, is that little phrase, forever and ever. That's the problem. The problem is not that this is talking about forever and ever. The problem is that that's not what the phrase means. All right? Now, you're going to have to take my word for it for today. Next week, we're going to spend the whole class, and we may actually spend two classes, tracing where this concept of time, distant time, comes from in the Bible, how it starts at the beginning of the Bible, and how the Bible uses the terminology all throughout the Hebrew Bible. It's very, very consistent. And then we'll look at how that it was translated into Greek by the translators of the Septuagint and why they translated it the way they did and what it meant in Greek at the time. Unfortunately, today people look at the Greek and they try to translate what is an idiom into something that is rigidly literal, and that's not how it was used. Do you guys know what an idiom is? It's an expression in a particular language that everybody understands, but you don't mean it literally. Like
kick the bucket?
I kicked the bucket. Everybody knows that means you died, but you didn't literally kick a bucket. Or I changed my mind. They know you didn't pull your brain out and put a different brain in, right? Or I dropped the ball. You know, there's lots and lots of idioms. Well, Greek has lots of idioms too, and so does Hebrew. All right, this phrase is an idiom. I'm going to prove that to you next week, and I'll show you what it actually means, okay? But for now, just take my word for it that it does not mean infinite time. It does not mean that at all, even though your English Bible implies that. Somebody's hand started up. Yeah, Jordan.
Yeah, I was looking at the Greek of the phrase, and when I'm just reading, it literally reads, I ace or into ages.
Of ages.
Of ages.
Yes, yes.
That sounds like a long time.
It does sound like a long time. But if you understand the history of the phrase and how it was used in the Old Testament in the Septuagint to translate specific Hebrew words, you'll see very clearly what it means. All right? But I don't want to give away my lesson next time because I don't want you to take my word for it because you trust me. I want you to take my word for it because I proved it to you beyond a reasonable doubt. All right? So I'm going to spend a whole class next week on it. All right. But for now, what I want you to see, all I want you to see from this passage is that this passage doesn't teach anything of the kind if that word, that phrase that you see there forever and ever, is doesn't mean infinity. All right? And that the context and the language of it fits. The grammar, all of it fits with them being tormented during that last 3.5 year period. All right? That's all I'm going to say about that for now. Now, the rest of my time, I want to talk about the fate. When we're talking about this class was titled The End of the Wicked. And if we're going to talk about the end of the wicked, we need to talk about the most wicked. That is Satan and his demons, right? Because the Bible says that Satan and his demons are going to come to an end too. They're going to be punished also. Let's go to Revelation chapter 20. I believe it's verse 10. Yes. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are. Now, you'll notice that the word "are" is in italics. That's because it's not in the Greek at all. It just says where the beast and the false prophet. It could mean "are," could mean "were," could mean "were cast." It doesn't tell us. But anyway, and they will be tormented day and night. And again, we have the same phrase that was used back in Revelation 14, which is in our English Bibles is translated forever and ever, but again, does not mean forever, infinity. And again, we'll talk about that next time. But here's what I want to do. I want you to take your Bibles and let's go to Isaiah 30, verse 33, because the Bible tells us that there was a specific place prepared for the devil. Right? You guys remember us going over this verse before? I don't hear anybody. Okay, Isaiah 30, verse 33. For Tophet was established of old. Yes, for the king it is prepared. He has made it deep and large. Its pyre is fire with much wood. The breath of the Lord, like a stream of brimstone, kindles it. Now, Tophet is prepared for the king as a place to be burned. Does anybody remember what Tophet is? We spent some time talking about Tophet. Gehenna. Tophet and Gehenna are the same place. And we looked a couple of weeks ago at several passages that use the two terms synonymously. In fact, some passages use both terms for the same place, all right? Gehenna, Tophet is the same place. It's the same place that Jesus said the wicked are going to be cast into throughout the gospel accounts. Many times he mentions that, all right? Now, I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 25. Matthew 25, 41. Then he will say, this is about the judgment at Christ's second coming when he divides the wicked from the righteous. And then it says, then he will say to those on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into everlasting fire. By the way, the word everlasting is simply the adjective form of the very same words that are translated forever and ever, the verbs in, or adverbs, I'm sorry, back in Revelation. Into everlasting fire. Now I want you to notice this, prepared for the devil and his angels. Now, Jesus talked about everlasting fire in Gehenna several times. So clearly when he says into everlasting fire, he means into Gehenna. All right. Now, who is Gehenna prepared for? The devil and his angels. Was Gehenna prepared for people? No. When God ordained Gehenna to be the place of burning, he didn't create it so that he could burn the wicked there. He created it, that is, the wicked as a class of people. He created it to destroy Satan and his angels there. But the wicked are going to be thrown in with Satan and with his angels there at this time. Okay? You guys get that? All right, now, here's the problem. What did Revelation 20 say? In Revelation chapter 19, it says that the beast and the false prophet were thrown alive into the lake of fire. And in Revelation 12, it says, I'm sorry, Revelation 20, verse 10, it says that Satan, this is the end of the kingdom, the end of the millennium, which is 1,000 years later, that Satan himself is going to be thrown in to the lake of fire. And it says where the beast and the false prophet are, or were thrown, right? And then it says, and they, three beings, they shall be tormented, right? Or they shall, what did it say? Revelation 20:10. They shall be tormented, and literally the Greek says, unto the ages of the ages, the same phrase that we saw before. Revelation 20:10. The devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone, where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Now, who is it that is in there being tormented? The devil, the beast, and the false prophet, right? Now, here's the question for you. Are the beast and the false prophet demonic beings, or are they men? Any guess? Okay. I'm glad you brought that up. Keep your finger here, and I want you to look at 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Because we have what appears to be a contradiction. It's not a contradiction if you understand it correctly, but it appears to be a contradiction, all right? 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it talks about the Antichrist, and it calls him the man of sin. Verse 3 says, let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed. Now, is the man of sin a human being, or is he a demonic entity? Why? He's a man. And the Greek word there is anthropos, which always refers to human beings. All right, so it says, the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition, who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God or worship, so that he sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Now, I want you to skip down to verse 9. The coming of the lawless one, and that's the man of sin, is in accord with the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. For this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they may all be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness. But we are bound to give thanks to God always for you, brethren. Actually, I skipped the part that I wanted to read. verse 7. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he is taken out of the way, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord, now notice this, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. Wait a minute. If he's going to consume and destroy him at his coming, why does Revelation say the beast and the false prophet are cast in to be tormented day and night unto ages of ages, literally is what the Greek says? Which is it? Does he consume him with the brightness of his coming and destroy him with his coming? Or does he torment him for an extended period of time? That's a problem, isn't it? All right, let me show you another problem. Go to Daniel chapter 7. Verse 11. Now, this is talking about the Antichrist also. It's talking about the little horn on the last beast, who is the Antichrist, if you were to study the whole book of Daniel. I watched then because of the sound of the pompous words which the horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and its body destroyed and given to the burning flame. As for the rest of the beasts, they had their dominion taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season of time. Now, what is Daniel saying? He's physically killed. Isn't that what he's saying? He's physically destroyed. His body is destroyed and given to the burning flame. Now, is that consistent with what Paul said in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2? Yes. It's consistent with that. He's going to be killed and destroyed by the brightness of Christ's coming. He's going to be thrown there. But look what Revelation says. Go back to Revelation 20:11. Or 20:10. I'm sorry, not 20:10. Yeah, 20:10. The beast and the false prophet. Here we are 1,000 years later, and the beast and the false prophet are going to be tormented after that, along with Satan, for an extended period of time, or for a period of time. Okay? And this is 1,000 years later. Now, either he is destroyed at the second coming of Christ, or he's still hanging around 1,000 years later when Satan's thrown in there. Okay? Yes.
Is he resurrected to face the judgment?
Go ahead, Jordan. Why don't you take a stab at it? Resurrected?
Right? The second. Because there's a first one, the one who, those who, right? I know there's two resurrections. One at the coming of Christ, and then later the judgment seat, the throne of God will be.
Yeah.
Like where
I'm there is a second resurrection.
The sea and yeah. All the dead will rise. And
yeah.
Before the lamb. And
yeah. The okay, that's one possible solution. But I'm going to give you the solution I think is correct.
Okay.
All right? And that is, when you read Daniel and when you read Thessalonians, there it's clear that both of them are talking about a king, a physical human being. Who is that person who's going to commit the abomination of desolation and all that stuff? He's a man. He's going to be born from a woman. He's going to grow up just like a man. And at some point, he's going to all of a sudden begin doing this hideous, devious acts, all right? But what's fascinating about this is the book of Revelation. What Revelation tries to do is instead of just looking at things the way they appear, it tries to pull back the veil so that we can see the demonic and the angelic realm and what's going on in the demonic and the angelic realm at the same time. And it talks about the beast coming up out of the abyss and killing the two witnesses. Now, wait a minute. And this is the one who's going to, if you read chapter 17, this is the beast that Satan gives his power and authority to for the 42 months, to reign for 42 months. But it's a beast who, or a entity that comes up out of the bottomless pit, out of the abyss. Now, if he's a man, he's not coming up out of the abyss. Right? So what we have is Revelation seems to clash with Daniel, and it seems to clash with 2 Thessalonians, which portrays this guy as a man. But you know, Thessalonians also talks about the mystery of iniquity, which is already working, but then the man of sin being revealed later. Not only that, 1 second, Jordan. Not only that, Revelation 17 says that he was, he is not, and he will be again. Now, wait a minute. Is a man going to be resurrected to be the Antichrist? No. It's a demonic power that was behind an ancient kingdom that was thrown into the abyss that is going to come up again and possess a man, a human being, the man of sin. And that, so the Antichrist is really two entities in one. He's a man that's possessed by a demon. All right, now, is that possible for a man to be possessed by a demon? I mean, we got lots of examples of it in the Gospels, don't we, that Jesus cast demons out of people. Isn't that right? So the beast or this entity, and the false prophet as well, you see him coming up out of the earth in Revelation chapter 13. He's another demonic entity. So we have the beast and the false prophet as two human beings, but at the same time, they're two demonic entities that have entered into these men and have taken over their bodies and are then performing their wicked works through the agency of these human hosts, if you want to call it that. So let me ask you this. Daniel says that this beast is going to be thrown into the fire and destroyed, and it says his body given to the burning flame. It specifically says his body is destroyed and thrown into the flame. Or it's thrown in the flame and destroyed. That's how it's destroyed. Paul says that the man of sin is going to be destroyed at the coming of Christ. But he's talking about the man, not the demonic spirit. But when we're talking about the beast in Revelation, it can be talking either about the man or the demon that inhabits him. And my opinion is that in chapter 20 of Revelation, when he's talking about the beast, the false prophet, and Satan being tormented after the millennium, that it is that demonic entity that entered into the man whose body was destroyed 1,000 years earlier, but now this demonic entity is going to be tormented for an extended period of time. Yeah, Jordan.
Interesting connection in the Gospels when he sees Legion.
Yeah.
They doubt, they are fearful of him. And they call him the Holy One. And they say they're going to torment us before the time.
Yeah.
Before, so they know that.
They know their destiny.
They know that they're going to be tormented eventually.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yes.
So just for clarification's sake, when the resurrection of the wicked, this hearing judgment happens, if there's people, like evil people, like the Antichrist, the man, and the false prophet, the man, that will be destroyed at Christ's first coming, for the second coming, they're just done. That's it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they're not to be resurrected again. They're through the whole
no.
kind of thing. So there are those that are just
Those who are alive who have taken the mark of the beast, yes.
Okay.
Yes, they're going to be destroyed, and that's the end of it for them.
Okay.
Yeah. Now, at the second resurrection, 1,000 years later, that's for the rest who had not been involved in that,
okay.
who had lived prior to that, they're coming forth to be judged as well. But the wicked, those who took the mark of the beast, are judged. In fact, they judge themselves. How do they judge themselves? The passage we read in Revelation 14. If you take the mark of the beast, you're condemned. So by taking the mark of the beast, they're condemning themselves. So when Christ returns, it's just poof, he's gonna do away with them. All right? He's gonna torment them for the time while they're worshiping the beast, but then they're gonna die. They're gonna be killed and destroyed and thrown in, their bodies are gonna be thrown into Gehenna. All right. I hope that helps clarify that. Now, again, as I said before, we're gonna talk about this expression forever and ever and everlasting and eternal. Those expressions in English, we're going to talk about them. We're going to look at the Hebrew of where they came from and how they were translated into Greek, and then how the New Testament borrows from the Septuagint, the Greek Old Testament, to use the same terminology. But see, the difference is when the apostles used that language, they understood what it meant as an idiom in Greek and how it was used to translate a Hebrew concept. All right, so we have to get back to the beginning so that we have that foundation. So, all right, that'll be next time. Any other questions or comments about this? Yes?
I'm sorry, just now when you said, like, their bodies would be thrown in Gehenna.
Yeah.
Didn't you say, like, Gehenna was, like, the place for, like, the beast, the false prophet?
Yes.
The devil?
Yes.
Like, only a place for them?
Well, it was originally created for them. In other words, God didn't intend it for human beings, but he's going to throw humans there as well. Because of their wickedness and rebellion and following Satan. When he's talking about it was prepared for the devil and his angels, he means that was its original intention, not that nobody else will be there. Because in Matthew 25, he specifically says that the wicked are going to be thrown there as well. Yes?
So there are no verses that support like some like suffering and like fiery domain that people like.
There is no.
To, like, Hades kind of.
There is nothing like that in the Bible.
The word Hades is.
It is, yeah. And, you know, we talked a little bit about this last week, but one of the saddest things, in my opinion, that is so misleading is the way that the word hell is used in our English translations of the Bible. Because the words Hades and the word Hebrew word Sheol, which is its equivalent, whenever you have Sheol in the Hebrew Bible, you have Hades in the Greek version of the Bible in the very same verses. Sometimes they translate it as the grave. Many times they translate it as the grave. Because the context makes it clear that it's the grave. It's because it talks about their bodies being placed there. It talks about soldiers being buried in Hades with their helmets and their shields at their sides. Well, we know that ghosts don't have shields and helmets, right? So it's clearly talking about a burial ritual when it's talking about Hades. And there are other places where, you know, like Jacob talks about, I'm going to go down in with my gray hairs into the grave, right? That translated as the grave there, and it's Hades. But yet, if there's a context where it could have this, let me put it this way. If the passage isn't specific and you can sort of understand it to mean, you know, this pagan idea of a subterranean fiery place, then they'll translate it as hell. But those are totally different concepts. Why is the same word being translated to two totally different concepts? See? And then it's further complicated when we get in the New Testament, because there, Gehenna, which the Old Testament clearly tells us is a place outside of Jerusalem where the corpses are going to be thrown. Isaiah talks about this. Jesus quoted Isaiah. You know, we talked all about that before. And they translate the word Gehenna as hell, which confuses it even more. You know, so you've got is the grave hell? Or is there some subterranean place? Is that hell? Or is hell some place outside of Jerusalem? Because by translating it incorrectly, instead of just being consistent with the words, if they would take Sheol and Hades and always translate it as the grave, all the passages would make perfect sense. It's just it doesn't support that theological point of view, that there's some, you know, cavern under there where all the ghosts are. It just doesn't support that. So by not being consistent with the way they're translating it and playing sort of a musical chairs with the term hell, they have justified the modern concept as though it's accurate and hidden the truth by doing that. But if we're just consistent with the text, it all makes perfectly good sense that way. So we shouldn't be massaging the text in our translations in order to accommodate these concepts that I don't believe are biblical at all.